If you love the History Extra podcast, make sure you follow us to keep up to date and get all the latest episodes. Thanks for your support, and I do hope you enjoy this episode.
This episode is brought to you by Amazon Prime. You know Amazon Prime is not just a shipping subscription, right? It's got everything, including streaming TV and movies on Prime Video. And of course, Prime's fast, free shipping. Go from watching your favorite shows to getting your favorite things. Whatever you're into, it's on Prime. Visit amazon.com/prime to get more out of whatever you're into.
Hey, welcome to IKEA, where even this desk is circular.
Huh. How so? Looks pretty rectangular to me.
It's because we're always looking to repair, reuse, and relove our products, like buying back your IKEA items for store credit. Or shop our as-is section for great deals. You can even order free spare parts. Get on the circular path for a more sustainable future.
Still a rectangle.
Get started at ikea-usa.com/circular. Visit ikea-usa.com/circular for as-is information and buyback and resale terms and conditions. Spare parts not available for all products.
He had a kind of a presence, as when I met him many decades later, it was very obvious. He just had a presence which was not an arrogant presence, but a presence of somebody you did not want to kind of cross. Not because he was a villain or a thug or anything like that, quite the opposite. He was just so strong and almost regal, and that goes back to the chiefdom. I mean, he was in his chiefdom terms a royal, and he rather saw himself that way, to be perfectly frank.
That was Peter Hain discussing Nelson Mandela.
You're listening to the History Extra podcast from BBC History Magazine. We're the UK's best-selling history magazine, available in print and several digital formats all over the world. Find out more at historyextra.com/subscribe or look out for us in your digital newsstand or app store.
Hello and welcome to the History Extra podcast. I'm Rob Attar, the editor of BBC History magazine. This week marks the centenary of the birth of Nelson Mandela, one of the towering figures of the 20th century. His life story is the subject of a new book by the politician and author Peter Hain. And we sent our deputy digital editor, Eleanor Evans, to meet Peter in London to find out more.
I'm really pleased to be talking with Lord Peter Hain, a Labour peer who was a Member of Parliament for 24 years, a senior minister in Tony Blair and Gordon Brown's governments, and a leading campaigner in the anti-apartheid movement. Thanks so much for joining us on the History Extra
podcast. It's a pleasure. Delighted.
So your latest book is Mandela, His Essential Life, and it chronicles the life and legacy of Nelson Mandela, his struggle against apartheid, his time in captivity to his role as a leading statesman. And obviously your book is about Mandela, but it's also about your own experiences knowing him and following his career, his own struggle against the apartheid regime. But I hoped we could just start by exploring a little bit of your own part in the international struggle against apartheid.
Well, the book itself is the only concise, readable story. There are lots of great biographies, Anthony Sampson's, for example, but they're long and they're learned. This doesn't pretend to be like that. It is the story that you can read quite easily and quickly. My involvement came from being the son of brave anti-apartheid activists, Walter and Adeline Hain, my parents, in Pretoria, when they were... took a stand that they didn't need to. Only a tiny fraction of the white population in South Africa under apartheid actually did stand up against it, and I'm proud that they were amongst them. And their involvement at an ordinary level that we would take for granted politically here, putting out leaflets, holding meetings, standing in elections and so on, led to them being jailed without... a charge for 2 weeks. One of my earliest memories was being woken up in the middle of the night and being told that they were being put in jail, and they disappeared for a couple of weeks. And I was 11 at the time. And then they were successively issued with banning orders. My mother was banned in 1963, and that restricts you enormously. It stops you being politically active, at least openly. You can't be quoted in public. You can't meet more than one other person at a time. And you can't go on school premises and things like that. So their anti-apartheid activity was, in a sense, in my DNA from a very young age in Pretoria, from 10, 11 particularly, and then increasingly through my teens to the point where life became so difficult that they stopped my father working as an architect, and he was restricted by then Band himself. Incidentally, they had to get special permission to talk to each other because Band people were prevented from communicating with another Band person. And the authorities were embarrassed about the situation that they discovered for the first time. And eventually they stopped my dad working as an architect in Pretoria, to which he was confined and couldn't leave, so he couldn't get work elsewhere. And we came to Britain in 1966.
So that gives us a bit of a background of your own experiences of apartheid. But if we could talk more generally, I suppose, about the South Africa that Mandela was born into, what were the restrictions in place?
Well, apartheid was introduced from the late 1940s onwards, after the Second World War, by the Afrikaner part of the white population. The white population in South Africa, about 10% of the overall population, was divided between English-speaking whites and Afrikaans-speaking whites. Afrikaans derived from Dutch and Flemish languages. From the 17th century onwards, people started settling in South Africa. The British came later. Mandela was born in 1918, so this is his centenary year. He was born into a rural life and was a herd boy, herding sheep in particular in his youth. And at that stage, of course, with British rule having existed then for some decades, the British having taken over South Africa before granting it independence in 1910, really the basis of racism was already there. But it didn't get fully institutionalized until the late 1940s and beyond under the system of apartheid. So he was brought up in a way that, as he said, it was almost a crime to be a black. That increasingly intensified under apartheid. But there was racism, there was segregation, and so I always think it's a mistake to say apartheid only began under the Afrikaner minority white pop government of the 1950s, 60s, 70s, 80s. Actually, it began under British colonial rule.
So this is the South Africa that Mandela grew up in, and you say in the book, you make clear in the book, that a very important thing to understand about Mandela is that from a very young age in this rural upbringing, he was groomed to be a chief in the Eastern Cape. How do you think that informed his politicisation, his education?
I don't think it informed his politicisation so much as when he did become politicised, which was relatively later on, certainly not in his youth and not into his early 20s. Then it became important, because he had been brought up to expect to succeed his father and maybe others higher up the chain of his chiefdom, the Tembu people, a clan within the Khoza people of South Africa. And so he had always expected to be a leader and had been groomed as such. So when he got involved in politics, and in particular supporting the African National Congress, which was the majority organization of black people in South Africa, and he was introduced to it by his mentor and close comrade Walter Sisulu, who's a very important figure to understand in his life, he then increasingly got involved, but it wasn't an overnight conversion. It was a gradual thing. And at that point, his leadership potential started to be visible, certainly to Sisulu, who saw him as a future leader from a very young age. But you cannot understand that without his chiefdom grooming to fulfill that role.
Mm-hmm. And as you just mentioned, Sisulu is a hugely important figure in Mandela's life, and that comes across in your account. They both were instrumental in the ANC Youth League being established, and from what I understand, it followed quite Gandhian principles of... can you explain what their aims were early on and how they came to be established?
Well, Mandela, Sisulu and others were part of a group of young Turks, if you like, who felt increasingly frustrated at the traditional means of lobbying by the ANC leadership. We're talking now early 1950s, late 1940s, early 1950s, relying on writing letters, parliamentary deputations, that kind of thing, which were getting them nowhere. Indeed, on the contrary, apartheid was, the vice and noose of apartheid was being remorselessly tightened almost month by month. And so they felt we've got to do something much more dramatic to assert the right of black people to have their freedom respected and to secure justice. And that's why they introduced, yes, Gandhian tactics of nonviolent direct action, feeling that, you know, the old conventional lobbying methods were getting them nowhere. And they weren't, objectively they weren't. I mean, the African National Congress had been formed around the turn of the century, the 20th century, and it had pursued this constitutionalist, gradualist, conventional, respectable form of lobbying for decades and decades. And then apartheid just got worse and worse. They felt they had to do something dramatic, stay at homes, black workers who were working in the white cities supporting white businesses and families were urged to stay at home in the townships that ringed these cities exclusively for blacks. And strikes, rent boycotts, bus boycotts, boycotting the buses that took them into the cities from their homes in the townships. Those kind of tactics, which then, however, provoked even greater repression by the apartheid system, which was not just a system, the worst system of racial tyranny that the world has ever seen, in my view, but also enforced by an increasingly ruthless and merciless police state.
I think I skipped us forward a bit then, and it would be great to go back a little and discuss the Population Registration Act in 1950, which was perhaps the start of the regulation and restriction proper, I suppose. Although, as you mentioned, it was going back hundreds of years. So could we talk a little bit about how that restricted and regulated and how the evil regime affected the lives of black people in South Africa?
The Population Registration Act is actually the key bit of groundwork legislation to the whole apartheid edifice above it, in that it divided the population into four racial groups: whites, Africans, blacks, Asians, that's to say from India and Pakistan, mainly India actually, both Muslim and Hindu, and then coloureds, a specific racial group still today in South Africa, which were mixed race people and call themselves coloured. And coloured in a British context is seen as a term that is almost patronising towards black people. But in South Africa, it's a specific racial group. And that Population Registration Act defined them and defined where they could live and a whole lot of other rights or the deprivation of rights that followed. And it had an almost Orwellian definition of whiteness. You know, a white person means a person who is obviously not a white person, and so on, in a clause that I extract and make prominent in the book. The important thing about apartheid as it grew is it entered and infiltrated every nook and cranny of life. So that, for example, park benches were segregated, buses were segregated, hospitals were segregated, schools were segregated. You could not have interracial sex. You could not marry on an interracial basis. Even to the extent that when Mandela eventually ended up in prison on Robben Island, it was specified, because there were only non-white prisoners on Robben Island, coloured Asian or African in the main, black Africans, even that Mandela was only allowed a certain specified ounces of fat or meat a day, whereas coloureds or Asians were allowed slightly more, like half an ounce more. So this was Nazi-like precision about the extent to which the races were treated in a discriminatory way and divided amongst themselves from the bed to the school to the hospital and right into prison. And it goes without saying, job reservations, so that, for example, Blacks could do the undercoat when decorating or painting a house, but could not do the top coat. Black building workers could pass a brick to a white bricklayer, but could not lay the bricks, even though they're quite capable of doing it themselves. A very good friend of ours, who was a clerk for many years in Pretoria Magistrates Court, suddenly they changed the regulations and he was no longer able to be employed. That was reserved for a white man. A white man, by the way, usually, not a white woman. He had to train his white successor. So I think it's important to understand how ubiquitous this apartheid system was and how Orwellian it was by definition.
And as you mentioned earlier, it's these regulations, so pervasive regulations, that Mandela, Sisulu and the ANC are working against. And while committed to non-violent policies early on, you pinpoint the demolition of Sophiatown, as the moment where Mandela realises that perhaps a more militant approach might be needed, and actions which would later see Mandela branded by some as a terrorist follow.
It's by the mid-1950s when Sophiatown was demolished. Now, Sophiatown was a part of Johannesburg, which was relatively was a black area in an area which the expanding city of Johannesburg had designated for whites. So the people were just cleared off it. And the ANC resisted it and had we will not move, we will not be moved. Well, they were moved by sheer military and police power and great violence. And I think that was a turning point in the sense that he felt they'd moved from useless lobbying to effective non-violent direct action. That even was being completely repressed. And meanwhile, year by year, more legislation was coming through the White Parliament to enforce apartheid in an even more systematic and oppressive fashion. And that is when he started to kind of articulate in his mind that actually they may be driven to violent resistance as well, although that did not actually get executed until around 1960, when the African National Congress, his organization, was banned along with others, made illegal. So then they were faced with a situation where nonviolent resistance had been crushed, conventional lobbying was a complete waste of time, their own organization had been banned, they were in many cases banned or imprisoned as individuals, and they took a decision with Mandela in the lead to go underground and to form an underground organization, paramilitary organization, Umkhonto Sizwe, short for MK, the African National Congress's underground guerrilla organization. I liken it as a decision comparable to that of the French partisans resisting the Nazis in occupied France, where they were driven to sabotage and to resistance, armed resistance against the Nazis, because they had no alternative. Mandela didn't choose that, and he very strongly distinguished, and he kind of, in an intellectual way, worked out with his comrades like Sisulu how they should take this fateful course. And they excluded terrorism, that's to say the killing or the harming of it on an indiscriminate basis of a civilian population that just happens to be on the spot at the time. And to go for government installations, military installations, and pylons, electricity pylons, and so forth. Acknowledging, however, to himself and as a group, that there was a danger that somebody walking past who had no connection with that apparatus of the apartheid state could be caught in the crossfire or actually killed. So he was very conscious of that. But I would defend the action as being there being no alternative but to total submission.
You mentioned how they were forced underground, and Mandela was also living underground. And a really interesting part of your book was describing the kind of guises he assumed when he was underground.
Yes, in those days, whites, if they had a chauffeur, were typically driven around with the white car owner, boss sitting in the back seat, and a black chauffeur in the front, wearing a cap and a uniform, typically. And that's what Mandela did. And he was able to drive all over the country with white activists who were part of the resistance and escaped detection for a long time and was known as the Black Pimpernel. He would pop up, do a meeting, give a newspaper interview, then disappear for a few months, and then somewhere else in quite the other end of the country pop up again. And this was also a significant time for him because his wife, Winnie Mandela, whom he'd married a few years before, very vivacious, strong, he thought too headstrong, and that was to play its part in later years. And her, their little daughters, he had two little daughters that he virtually never knew. So hardly had they been married, then he went underground, and she would have to be brought to him in hiding, secretly, the route changing to throw off any pursuers, because she was watched. And there he would be able to see her and spend a bit of time with her on a kind of brief basis and occasionally see his tiny little daughters.
And it was from this existence that he was arrested and put on trial. And the Rivonia trial of 1963, where he gave a very famous address, which you quote in the book. What can you tell us about his presence when he was on trial?
Well, he was first arrested, of course, and betrayed from within the organisation, and subsequent evidence suggested and was suspected at the time by the CIA, by the American Intelligence Service, and then put on trial on his own in Pretoria, a trial my mother attended. And when he used to go into the dock, he would turn to the gallery reserved for blacks and salute them, and they'd return the salute. It was packed. She was often, my mother, the only white in the gallery, almost always, as reporting the trial for an activist newspaper. And he would turn to her and they'd raise their suits, their fists in a salute to each other. So he was then sent to Robben Island after being convicted for the offences associated with going underground and leaving the country, including coming to Britain. And then brought back from Robben Island for the Rivonia trial, when his other comrades, Sisulu, Kathrada, Mbeki and Mlangeni and the others were arrested. And they were based at a farm called Lily's Leaf, which is now a beautiful museum in a suburb of Johannesburg called Rivonia, and thereby it became the Rivonia trial. And famous because they were on trial for their lives. The charges were so serious, treason and so on, that the automatic sentence you could have expected and they expected was to be executed, as many hundreds of activists were, hung by the neck in a grisly fashion, was the norm at that stage. And what elevated Mandela to even greater international importance, and for that matter domestic importance as well, because by then he was the leader of the ANC, was his defiant speech from the dock when asked whether he had anything to say in mitigation. And he argued with his lawyers about this, who tried to persuade him not to say it. He basically said, you know, I'm proud of what I've done. I have stood for a society in which black people have equal rights and in which white people have equal rights as well. Importantly, that was always the case for Mandela. And it's an ideal for which I have struggled, and an ideal for which I'm prepared to die. So he was effectively saying to the judge, and this is what his lawyers feared it would result in, was, you know, put the noose around my neck and execute me. And it was an amazing speech, which fortunately didn't result, fortunately for him and fortunately for South Africa, did not result in his execution. Instead, life imprisonment in a tiny cell where his head and his feet sort of pressed against either end of the walls, cold and bleak in very difficult and oppressive conditions for nearly 27 years, before the end of which he was taken off and put into Polesmoor prison on mainland Cape Town.
And your book does track this this portion of Mandela's life, how conditions evolved within Robben Island, how he and his fellow prisoners pushed for better conditions. So what can you tell us about the conditions and the treatment that faced Mandela and his fellow political prisoners, and how did that inform him for his future leadership.
Well, when he arrived on Robben Island, he arrived by, as was the only route in, by a kind of ferry boat, the island's ferry boat, and his warders were urinating down the only air vent, a little hole in the kind of room in the base of the little boat where they were confined, deliberately urinating down their air vent. And when they got onto the island, they were chanting at him, "Here you will die." So it was very clear what was going to happen to him. And the objective of the warders and the whole regime was to basically intimidate and beat them into submission and terrorize them effectively. So they were subject to very harsh conditions, light burning during the night, prevented from reading and studying very easily, certainly in the early years, prevented from getting newspapers or any outside news, and had to grind stones in a courtyard or dig out lime from a lime quarry, which in the harsh sunlight blinded them. And so Mandela's eyesight was very damaged when he came off the island eventually. It's very, very tough indeed. And they were frequently beaten up, except for Mandela. And somehow, and this is part of who he was and who he became as the leader of his country, he had a kind of a presence, as when I met him many decades later, it was very obvious. He just had a presence which was not an arrogant presence, but a presence of somebody you did not want to kind of cross. Not because he was a villain or a thug or anything like that, quite the opposite. He was just so strong and almost regal. And that goes back to the chiefdom. I mean, he was in his chiefdom terms a royal. And he rather saw himself that way, to be perfectly frank. Not in an intimidating, as I say, or a kind of patronizing fashion, but that's just who he was, the way he carried himself, the way he related to people and so forth. And on one occasion when he was threatened with being beaten up, he said to the warder, because he was a lawyer by training himself and had practiced law, the very successful black law firm in the 1950s in Johannesburg with Oliver Tambo, his compatriot, leader of the ANC, who became the international leader in exile when Mandela was in prison. And he said to this warder, "If you touch me, I will make sure you are prosecuted in court and you will be reduced to the judge, to humiliated by the judge." And they never touched him. And then gradually he got beyond that resisting intimidation to spreading that sort of sense of security to his colleagues, who were still badly treated by comparison with him. And then to beginning to think about how he could relate to his warders, understanding they were poorly educated, they were all Afrikaans, they spoke Afrikaans, so he started to learn the language fluently. And then that's then related to them, talked in Afrikaans to them, and they began to respect him more and relate to him as an individual. And then even deeper than that, he started to believe, in fact, he never lost this belief, that there would in the end be negotiations, that his white oppressors would be forced, the apartheid rulers, to come to him and his comrades in prison and help negotiate a transition towards a non-racial society. So that was always his conviction, which sustained him and Sisulu and the others all the way through, but above all Mandela. And so he decided that if it was going to get to that point, if indeed what he believed and hoped would occur and did occur, that his Afrikaner white rulers would ultimately have to come and talk to him, he decided he would learn their history, because the history of the Afrikaans people is a very interesting one and quite a tragic one. They were themselves oppressed by the British. Remember, the first ever concentration camps were not in Nazi Germany. They were actually during the Boer Wars, when the British fought the Afrikaner whites for dominance and control of the gold fields and the mines and so on. It was about the traditional colonial objective of plundering the assets of the country, and it resulted in two bloody wars. And concentration camps, I think 25,000 Afrikaans women and children were killed and then died in miserable, horrible, insanitary conditions in those concentration camps. And that's very much part of Afrikaner folklore, that this will never happen to us again. And therefore, we have to have a strong state that defends our people, our folk in Afrikaans. And we have to, you know, be very strong. And so when he started to learn their history and the history of their generals and you know, their military tactics and their culture and so on, increasingly he started talking to the prison governors in these terms, not just the warders who were not very well educated. But the first time they sent the police minister to talk to him, we're talking now about early to mid-1980s, he started talking to me in those terms. And from that point on, every time he would talk in Afrikaans and talk about how interested he was in their history and so on. So they came to see him not as, you know, the prisoner, the terrorist ogre, but actually as a person and as a formidable person. And then beyond that, as actually somebody that could save them from the fate that South Africa was beckoning for it.
Yeah, that's a really interesting point, I think, that definitely comes across in the book, is Mandela's transformation, particularly among white South Africans and in the media, from feared enemy to national hero. So could you talk perhaps about how that transition came about?
Well, he went into prison as a burly freedom fighter and with a touch of arrogance and vanity. And he became increasingly humble but strong, not humble in the sense of being downtrodden, on the very contrary, very upright and refusal to be intimidated, even facing the most difficult circumstances. And I think what he then gains is wisdom and understanding and an ability to relate to the other side in a negotiation, in the end, to any conflict. Northern Ireland, for example, which I helped negotiate a settlement for in 2007, bringing in Paisley and Martin McGuinness into power, you need to understand the interests involved. Why are people acting in this way? It's no good just seeing them, as in Mandela's case, as the oppressors, as the bad people. Why are they acting in that way? How can you reach out and understand that whilst not conceding your ground at all? And so gradually that developed, and he persuaded his colleagues to go along that route. So when they came to speak to him, and later speaking to him on his own, which worried him a little, although he was ambivalent about it, it worried him a little because he didn't want to be seen to be isolated from his comrades, and they were concerned about that. On the other hand, he had a very clear idea of a leader. A leader has to lead. A leader has to go out ahead of their followers sometimes. So I think all of that was developed as a prisoner.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
We don't always realize just how much our negative thoughts and experiences stick with us and weigh us down. You may find your brain constantly running through a highlight reel of bad moments. That comment your friend made last week that hurt your feelings. That frustrating thing your mum does. Or that silly thing you said in a meeting. Maybe it's time to get it all off your chest. Whether it's a tiny annoyance or something much bigger, talking about it can give you some relief and lead you to a potential solution. That's where therapy comes in. It's a safe space to share whatever's weighing you down and learn to process it so your internal highlight reel can focus on the good stuff. And BetterHelp offers affordable online therapy on a schedule that works for you. Connect with a licensed therapist by text, phone, or video call. Start the process in minutes and switch therapists anytime. Let it out with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/historyextra today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/HistoryExtra.
This episode is brought to you by Amazon Prime. You know Amazon Prime is not just a shipping subscription, right? It's got everything, including streaming TV and movies on Prime Video. And of course, Prime's fast, free shipping. Go from watching your favorite shows to getting your favorite things. Whatever you're into, it's on Prime. Visit Amazon.com/Prime to get more out of whatever you're into.
You reference a Bill Clinton quote in your book, which says he learned to hate the apartheid cause without hating white South Africans. And for you, how much does that quote speak to the uniqueness of his character and his strengths as a leader?
It speaks volumes, but also to his experience, where he didn't have an ounce of bitterness or vengeance in him. His motto was forgive but never forget. In other words, reach out to your oppressors, but never forget that you've been oppressed. Never allow yourself to be compromised. And so when, for example, President Buerta in the mid-1980s actually tried to get him to renounce the ANC and renounce the armed struggle in exchange for his own freedom, he refused point blank. He said, I cannot be free unless my people are free, and I will not accept some deal because I'm becoming an embarrassment to the government in prison, because by this stage, his name, they had hoped in imprisoning him for life that he would disappear, never to be heard of again. In fact, the longer he was in, the more prominent his name became globally, to the point in the 1980s when you see, for example, the Free Nelson Mandela concert in 1988 that was a wonderful event, beamed to 600 million people on live television across the world. He was a global figure. That transformation occurred in prison as well.
You've already mentioned her, and it seems that we can't talk about Mandela without talking about Winnie Mandela as well. And her legacy is a complicated and controversial one, but what did she represent for Mandela during his incarceration?
Well, she was his indispensable support. But he felt, and this is the kind of complex thing about Mandela, it's really important to understand. He was this incredible leader, but privately he was actually very, very anguished. He hated the fact it kind of tore him apart internally and wounded him inside, that he couldn't be a proper father to his two young daughters, who were toddlers when he went into prison, and he never got to know until they were adults. His wife, bringing them up in the intolerable conditions, being beaten, being stripped in prison, being banned, being sent away, banished to a remote area, way away from her friends and her home in Johannesburg in Soweto. Even deprived while she was in detention of sanitary towels, things like this. It just grisly, nasty, mean and vicious and petty means of trying to humiliate her and suppress her. And she survived all that. And, you know, it's tremendously to her credit that she came through all that, still strong by his side, becoming increasingly prominent at the same time as being his voice on earth, if you were, because he couldn't be quoted. He's a banned person. You could not quote a banned person in public. So she became his kind of proxy, his surrogate. I think what that did was it went to her head a bit. He was always worried, Mandela, that she was a bit headstrong and impetuous rather than more kind of calculated and strategic as he was. And she was never, in a sense, a leader in the way that he was, of trying to bring people together. She was a kind of leader of her own particular strand in the political firmament and spectrum, political spectrum. And I think what that experience did in the late 60s and 70s, above all, is it brutalized her. The way she was able to survive is just by being so strong in herself and so sort of resistant to being intimidated that she became, in a way, a mirror of that. And then, you know, we get these very tragic, sad, and completely indefensible activities in Soweto in the 1980s, where she becomes a bit of a queen, really, and surrounded by young black admirers, some of whom she took as lovers, and Mandela United Football Club, which was a bunch of thugs that killed people and did things that she didn't know about. And she was ultimately put on trial for complicity in murder and convicted of it, but not sentenced to a long imprisonment, but a suspended one. By then, she was, in a sense, the first lady, in quotes, because he'd become president. So I think it's a complex story to assess Winnie's, and in a way a microcosm of the horror of apartheid.
So there are these meetings then, clandestine at first and then more public as the movement grows. I know you yourself were obviously a big part of the international campaign to free Mandela. And then there's the moment that he walks free. What can you tell us about that moment, both from your own experiences and what it meant?
Well, there were incredibly intricate negotiations that went on that gradually got more and more regular and deeper. And in exile, the ANC was also meeting people they'd never met before across the divide. And then there was that moment that we'd all campaigned for, but never sort of quite believed would ever happen, when he walked to freedom from Victor Verster prison in the Cape Winelands outside Cape Town. By then, he'd been moved in the final period of his imprisonment to this prison house with its own swimming pool and a white, not so much warder, though he was in a prison compound, but almost like butler and assistant, as it were, an inversion of apartheid, where the white warder is actually serving the black prisoner rather than oppressing them. And there was this twist to it, where President de Klerk, who had himself served for 20 years in an apartheid government and cabinet without ever objecting to all the horror that he and his colleagues were unleashing, suddenly realised, in part having been briefed by those interlocutors of Mandela in the intelligence services and the police and the military and in government, that this was somebody he could do business with. De Klerk realised this was an economy going off the edge of the cliff. This was a society about to collapse into civil war with black uprisings in the townships and so on, and international sanctions really biting hard, including sporting sanctions. And he came to talk. He then released him and released some of his comrades before him. But that moment, well, you know, it was one of those never-forget moments. I mean, it was very emotional. I was watching it live on television in London, and, you know, my mother had sort of tears streaming down her face, and there was a lot of moist eyes amongst all of us in the family.
And from that moment on, Mandela is almost the incumbent, I suppose, although it's a little while to get to his leadership. When he travels, he's treated already like a leading statesman. What can you tell us about that moment leading up to his presidency? But it still wasn't solved, was there? Was still deep tensions and so much violence going on even after his release.
Well, the irony is people tend to forget that Nelson Mandela walked out of prison, then a few years later he was president, and isn't this a magical, almost miraculous story? And it was a bit of a miracle, really. Very few examples where such a privileged, oppressive elite gave up its power to the oppressed in a relatively seamless fashion. There was, however, more violence in between him walking out of prison and him becoming president in those 4 years than at any time under apartheid the previous 50 years. Why? Because de Klerk, and although he rightly received a Nobel Peace Prize along with Mandela, de Klerk and especially others in the apartheid elite in government and the state still believed they could hang on to power despite some accommodation to the black majority and to Mandela as their leader. And so they had this third force that was exterminating ANC people, stirring up tribal chiefdom kind of tensions and rivalries, particularly between the Zulus in KwaZulu-Natal and others, and trying to poison the whole context in the townships, for example, between older and younger people and so on. It was a deliberate divide and rule policy because they thought they could still hang on to a bit of the power. And they even thought they could do so right the way to the end. I mean, they didn't expect the ANC to get the landslide victory that it did. It quite a shock the white nationalist rulers that had released him. And it was because the constitution had been negotiated, that transitional constitution, in such a way that it was a power-sharing government. So President de Klerk, former President de Klerk, became one of Mandela's deputies. So they were still clinging on to the hope that they could actually stay in power and force Mandela to accept a kind of halfway house, which he wouldn't do. The interesting thing about Mandela, and a key to understanding him, and I bring this out in the book, is that he was very conciliatory, he was very accommodating to people, but he did not bend on the fundamental principles. He is absolutely inflexible. This was going to be majority rule, full stop. It may start off with a power-sharing government, but it was going to, you could not kind of compromise on that. So he was quite a tough person to deal with because, you know, he would be full of openness and trying to understand and find solutions and think laterally and all those things you have to do as a negotiator and a conflict resolver. But you could not shift him from the fundamentals, which is this was going to be one person, one vote. This was going to be real non-racial democracy, not some kind of fudge.
And so we do see this landslide win for the ANC and Mandela in 1994. And you were with him on the eve of his election. And you call him in the book a big picture president. So what was that moment like seeing him come to power? And how did that define his presidency going forward?
Well, I was with him on the eve of election just after his final press conference and just found myself in a room alone with him for 10 minutes, which is an extraordinary and privileged opportunity to have. And he was very subdued in a way. It was almost, you'd be thinking, I said, aren't you excited? He said, no, I just feel there's this awful responsibility hanging on my shoulders. He knew how difficult the task ahead lay, because remember that a lot of whites still were in fear, I mean, absolute terror of him taking over. I mean, I even remember one of my cousins telling me, whom I met when I was there as a parliamentary observer during the election, and I hadn't seen him for a long time. And he said to me, well, they've stocked up with lots of cans of baked beans and, you know, meat and all that kind of thing, because they didn't know whether there was going to be chaos. And so Mandela came to power, and within a very short space of time, he'd kind of morphed from feared terrorist into national saviour and hero for whites as well, typified by the 1995 World Cup final, which is interesting in a number of respects, a rugby cup final that South Africa, at this time a genuine South African team, drawn from all races, though still it was from mostly white rugby stock, played against the New Zealanders, the All Blacks. And Mandela took a decision, which I'd use as an example of leadership rather than followership. Leadership, which he exemplified in this instance and many others, was when your closest advisors are telling you, as they did then, do not wear the Springbok cap and the Springbok jersey, because it is the symbol of apartheid on the rugby field, as it was through all those decades of the struggle. It was a hard struggle. I mean, people take it for granted now. It was a really tough, hard struggle, and lots of sacrifices and resistance, including in the British Parliament and successive governments, conservative governments, against the ANC. It was a really tough battle. And he decided, no, he would wear this because this was a moment to heal the nation. And so he went on to the rugby field. And nobody expected this. Nobody. It was completely secret. His closest advisors implored him not to do it. And everybody rose as a person in that stadium. And they were 99% white. And of that 99%, I would think 90% Afrikaner. All his feared opponents, all his original oppressors, rose and chanted his name because of that moment that he had that insight, that willingness to make that extra step to reach out and to heal. And it was an important, it was a year into his presidency and, you know, he still had a lot of kind of legitimacy to to establish with the white minority. And he knew he had to do it. And this was an argument he had with others in the ANC and some of the more impetuous and radical younger element, that unless you wanted a South Africa in which there were no whites anymore because they all fled in terror, and if you did that, the country would be in deep trouble. Because where that had happened, in places like Mozambique and Angola, for example, where the Portuguese just pulled out, and mainly it was their responsibility, but there was not a properly brokered, negotiated transition. The liberation movements there were resisted to the last minute by the Portuguese. And finally, when the fascist dictatorship back in Lisbon had been overthrown, it suddenly collapsed. Mandela knew that you would still need white skills, you would still need white capital, you would still need white people in the country, because they were South Africans. Afrikaners were Africans just as much as he was, even though his people went back, you know, centuries before. Back to time immemorial. And I think it was that vision which was terribly important and exemplified in that World Cup final. And sport, you know, was very, very important in the transition, not just at that cup final, but even during the process between Mandela's release and him becoming president. There was a referendum which President de Klerk called amongst the white electors to get a mandate for his process of change. And one of the techniques that de Klerk and the others used in that election, in that referendum, was pictures from the Cricket World Cup final, I think in Australia, of around 1992 or so, in which South Africa was competing for the first time in a quarter of a century on equal terms with the rest of the world. And so it having become a stick to beat apartheid and defeat it, it became a carrot to bring about the transition, both in that use of those television pictures, which were very powerful and resonated with the electorate, that you may not be entirely happy about this, but you get your cricket and your sport back. And as I understood, as a young white South African being brought up in that culture, those fanatical sports fans, you know, they make the average England football fan or Welsh rugby fan look like, you know, amateurs, to be honest. And the loss of their sport was absolutely critical. When I first met Mandela, he told me about the campaigns that I had led in 1969-70 to disrupt the Springbok rugby tour using non-violent direct action, invading the pitch and so on. And it resulted in the whites-only cricket tour being cancelled in 1970 and then propelling white South Africa into sporting isolation thereafter. He said this was decisive at that time when the resistance had been crushed, but also because sport was so important. So having been a stick to battle against apartheid, it became a carrot to smooth the change forward.
Another thing that comes across very clearly in your account is his charisma and his eye for mischief. Can you talk a little bit about what you experienced of that?
The thing about Nelson Mandela, which set him apart from all the other world leaders that I've met, kings and queens and presidents and prime ministers and celebrities in sport and politics and rock music and so on, is that he was a people's person, first and foremost. He always was interested in the ordinary people that he encountered. And there was one occasion when this came to the fore. I was escorting him down from a higher floor in a Brighton hotel to meet Prime Minister Tony Blair on the eve of his addressing, that's to say Mandela's addressing the annual conference of the Labour Party. And a Prime Minister's diary is very rigidly, you know, organised. You get a schedule, and we had the slot, and I had it, you know, battered into me that I mustn't miss the start of it. So we're heading down in the lift to meet the Prime Minister. And he says, how's the family? And I said, well, my mother's in hospital with a broken femur, part of her leg. I must speak to her. And so I had to get her on the phone in hospital in Swansea. I didn't know the number or the ward she was in, track it all down via a director of inquiries. Meanwhile, we emerge out of the lift, the hotel lift, onto the same floor as Tony Blair. And there's this line of a couple of dozen waiters and cleaners and receptionists and bar people and so on waiting to see him. And he starts chatting to them and shaking them by the hand. Finally, I get my mother on the line. I say, there's a very important person to speak to you, but I don't reveal who it is. He comes on the line. This is Mandela from South Africa. Do you know who I am? So it's this self-deprecating sense of wit and humour and kind of breaking the ice. And there was another small example of that, and there are many, where Elizabeth and I invited him to our wedding in 2003, and you didn't expect him to accept, which he didn't, but he sent this very nice little note, and he said, I'm really sorry I can't come, but I'll be there next time. And of course, the audience at the wedding just burst out laughing. It was so funny. It's like sort of, you know, completely unexpected. And then one final one that springs to mind, though there are many others I could mention, was he always referred to Her Majesty the Queen as Elizabeth. And during his 90th birthday, there was a party here in London, and he got a message to say, and a phone handed him to say that the palace had been on the line and the Queen would like to speak to him. So he picks up the phone and he says, hello, Elizabeth, how's the Duke? And his wife, by then they'd been married some years, Grusha Michelle, a marvellous woman, and an incredibly talented and impressive person in her own right, ticks him off for calling Her Majesty Elizabeth. He said, you can't speak to the Queen. And he replies, and he says, but she calls me Nelson. So, you know, fair dues, as it were. So, you know, he would say to me, if I saw him in London when he was in the early 2000s, I would see him and he'd say, my wife will be along shortly. She's much more important than I am.
Mandela's life story is central to that of his country and your country. And why do you think it's important to have an accessible account of his life of this nature?
Well, I think in today's world, above all, not just for South Africa, where a lot of the so-called born frees, the people of whom, you know, comprise over 40% of the population, the people born after apartheid who never knew apartheid, I think it's really important for them to know the story and to be accessible. And that's what really motivated me and found it such a privilege to be asked to write it in these terms. But also for the world. I mean, Mandela's leadership, I think, stands as a symbol for good leadership in the world. There are far too many strong leaders in the world, strong men, as they like to see themselves, of an authoritarian kind, who really appeal to people's base instincts. And Mandela always appealed to people's higher instincts, to the better side of all of us. And I think his values of social justice, of democracy, of integrity. I mean, there's too much corruption in South Africa and has been for the last 10 years, and he was absolutely detested it and despaired about it and warned about it in the latter part of his presidency, which ended of his own choice, one of the very few African leaders to stand down before their terms ended, and some, of course, have extended them over the generations. He felt it really strongly that, you know, in integrity and sticking to the rule of law, he was a lawyer, sticking to the constitution, the best constitution in the world, these values, to the point even when there was an argument during his presidency about whether an investigation into the past crimes under apartheid, which also looked at crimes committed by the ANC in exile in Southern Africa against some of its own followers. There was attempts from within the ANC to suppress that part of the... Mandela said, no, we've got a Truth and Reconciliation Commission that is looked into the past. The past has to be revealed in all of its facets. So I think integrity is really important, and his uncompromising commitment to humanity. And there are lots of leaders around the world, and this is probably not the program to name them, where that just isn't the case. So I think he can stand as a benchmark for what I call good, principled, decent leadership, but not soft, you know, as it were, vacillating leadership, because there's nobody stronger that I've ever studied or met than Mandela. Nobody. But there's also very few, if any, more principled and committed to those values that he held so dear of social justice, inequality and human rights.
Well, it's a fantastic account, and thank you so much for talking to us about it today.
Oh, it's been great. Thank you.
That was Peter Hain. Mandela, His Essential Life, has just been published in both the UK and the US by Roman and Littlefield International. And that's about all for today, but we will be back next Monday when the topic of discussion will be Britain in the 20th century.
Thanks for listening to this History Extra podcast, which was produced by Jack Fletcher. Do let us know what you think about this episode by emailing podcast@historyextra.com, and we might read out your messages in future editions. Alternatively, why not keep in touch via Twitter or Facebook, where you'll find us at History Extra. For more great history content, don't forget to visit our website, historyextra.com, which is full of history articles, quizzes, image galleries, and more. Plus, it's where you can download hundreds of previous episodes of this podcast.